Today on the 21st, our Monday Reporters Roundtable with the latest on COVID-19 in Illinois and the protests over police violence. Then, June is Pride Month, but for a long time, a key force behind gay liberation has been written out of the history.
It's a beautiful moment because now I can let them know what it looks like to be a Black trans woman. Now I can let them know that you will not be liberated without me.
And with the announcement that the Illinois State Fair would be canceled this year, we'll talk about it with the owner of Vo's Fine Food and Drink, a corndog vendor that's one of the most popular booths on the Springfield Fairgrounds. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Monday morning, the State Department of Public Health continues announcing hundreds of newly confirmed COVID-19 infections every day, 672 on Sunday, 673 Saturday, plus scores of deaths. Meanwhile, protests continue over the police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, and the problem of racism in American life more generally. As always, we begin our week with a look at how these stories are playing out around Illinois with reporters from different parts of the state. Beginning in Chicago, Kristen Schorsch is a government and politics reporter at WBEZ. Kristen, welcome to the 21st. And we're also joined by Yvonne Booz, who is an arts and culture reporter at Northern Public Radio, WNIJ in DeKalb. Yvonne, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Ryan Denham, who is a reporter and digital content director at WGLT in Bloomington Normal. Ryan, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being on.
Good to be here, Brian.
So, Kristen, I want to begin with you. One of the big stories out of Chicago since we last went to air was about a cadre of police officers who were caught lounging around Congressman Bobby Rush's campaign office. Can you tell us about what happened there? And okay, we seem to be having some technical issues connecting to Kristen, so we'll come back to her in a moment. Yvonne, I'm going to turn to you instead and say you and your colleagues at WNIJ have been covering some of the protests in your area, which includes Aurora, DeKalb, and Rockford. Can you tell us what's been happening in that region?
Yes, I can. So I'll start off with Rockford. There were several protests going on the last couple of weeks. A lot of them that have been led by the Rockford Youth Activism Group. So I did get a chance to talk to Christopher Sims. He's a poet and activist in that area. And he said, you know, the young people are hurting just as much as everyone else. DeKalb, we had a few protests and then some looting started. I got a chance to talk to Joe Mitchell, the pastor of New Hope Missionary Baptist Church in DeKalb. And he was out there when people were looting and he was telling them, go home, please go home, because he said he was more concerned about their safety because there's enough, you know, there has been enough bloodshed in the African-American community. And then when we switch over to Aurora, you know, the first protest started May 31st. It was a Sunday. People gathered at the Aurora police station. It was pretty peaceful. I did go there to take some pictures. I didn't really talk to anyone because of COVID-19, but as I was walking up, they were saying, oh, now they're about to go to the outlet mall. And then from there later on, I was looking on Facebook, they ended up downtown and that's where the looting started. But my peer Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco did a feature about all the protests that have been going on, and people can find that if they go to WNIJ.org. And the name of that is called The Voices of Protest in Northern Illinois.
And so, I mean, do you have a sense if, I mean, we've heard in some cities that, you know, people have been taking pains to say that, you know, the people who are peacefully protesting are not necessarily the same ones who are perpetrating violence and, you know, destroying property, looting and things like that. Do you have a sense as to whether that's the case in your area?
I did have a local poet say that he was on his Facebook page, and he's been doing videos a lot, and he said that a lot of the looting that took place in the Aurora area were from people who weren't even from Aurora. But other than that, I hadn't heard too much of that.
And Yvonne, can you also tell us about, I know you interviewed a police chief who's stepping down in DeKalb there. I mean, is this idea of defunding the police coming up in the area there? Or is this something people are talking about?
What I'm hearing is a lot of people asking for changes with the police department. I know here locally in Aurora, there's been a big push. There was something sent to Chief Zimmon for Aurora asking for different changes. And there's actually a Facebook page called Aurora Demand, where you can go and see all the demands that they're asking for the police in Aurora to make changes. So I'm not hearing so much of the defunding. It's more of making changes. Like Mayor McNamara in Rockford put out something talking about he wants to talk to the citizens and find out what their concerns are and go from there.
Okay, interesting. Ryan, I'm going to bring you into the conversation. Ryan Denham at WGLT. What about in Bloomington Normal? Is defund the police something that's gaining traction or at least being talked about in your area?
It's being talked about, but not in any significant way by the significant players that would actually do it up to this point. There's been one Bloomington City Council member who has certainly pushed the idea, but I'm not sensing a ton of support for that. I think, like my counterpart there, there's just a general attitude toward wanting change. And I don't think defunding the police in any significant way is going to be part of that. I could be wrong, but that's certainly the sense I'm getting.
And are protests, Ryan, over the killing of George Floyd and police violence more generally, are they continuing in Bloomington Normal?
Yes. Yeah, we've had very active demonstrations and protests and rallies almost every day or two here in Bloomington Normal since George Floyd's death. And they're still reasonably sized. They're fading a little bit from that first one, but still a pretty healthy contingent of people are showing up for the demonstrations and a mix of people too. You know, young and old, people of color, white people. It's a real good mix here.
And has there been any violence or destruction associated with these protests, either from the demonstrators themselves or possibly from the police against the demonstrators?
No, not really. The demonstrations themselves have been largely peaceful. We've had two incidents against the demonstrators by outside parties, so not police. Hmm. A couple of men, two different demonstrations. One allegedly threw a smoke bomb, like you would buy at a store, kind of a harmless smoke device. But he threw it in the middle of a demonstration that kind of spooked some people, and he's since been criminally charged. More seriously, though, there was a man who allegedly drove a motorcycle into a crowd at a demonstration, actually injured a couple of people, and he has been arrested as well. Both of them have faced hate crime charges. But nothing from the police toward the demonstrators or the demonstrators toward police.
Okay, interesting. And Kristen Schorsch from WBEZ in Chicago, do we have you back on the line now? Kristen, are you with us? Okay. Yvonne, I'm going to turn back to you then and ask about artists in Aurora. And you're the arts and culture reporter for WNIJ. And I understand that from your reporting that some murals have been going up in the wake of these protests against police violence. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Actually, I called Jen Byrne Evans, just introducing myself, saying, you know, I'm new at WNIJ and here are some of the things I'll be covering. And she said, you know what, let me call you back. I'm on my way downtown for a meeting at 12. Well, I didn't know it was a meeting to figure out how to get things clean and looking good. So what I did, there is a graffiti artist. His name is Sam Cervantes. And I reached out to him because he was one of the first artists that start doing murals after the looting and the glasses. People, shops were their glasses were broken the night of the looting. So he had a friend that owned the nutrition shop, and she called him and asked if he could come and put something on her, the boarded up piece. And so he did, and he went, and he said he put Aurora Stronger, because he said, you know, we hear Aurora Strong, especially since last year, we've been hearing that a lot. But he said, you know what, we're going to come out of this stronger. And then the shop next to her, the jewelry shop, asked him to do something then. And he said, all of a sudden, like, more artists came out and they started doing murals and stuff just to beautify what was looted and torn up.
And does the downtown still look boarded up mostly, or is it beginning to kind of return to some semblance of normalcy, which whatever that is in the midst of a pandemic, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's still boarded up, but there's art everywhere.
Yeah, fascinating.
So it doesn't look bad.
Ryan, I want to shift gears a little bit, because you've done some reporting on the Eastland Mall in Bloomington Normal. And I wonder if you can talk about what's happening there, some of the financial problems they're facing.
Sure. Yeah. We're all sort of trying to take measurement of the economic impact of COVID-19. And one, you know, significant way it's playing out here is at our local mall, you know, which looks like any regional mall you'd find in the Midwest. It's owned by a company called CBL Properties. And that mall has been struggling for years, right? I mean, it was vacant, more than half vacant, long before this COVID happened. But 2 weeks ago or so, they had a new regulatory filing with the SEC that said essentially that their ability to operate as a going concern moving forward was in substantial doubt. And that's sort of accountant speak for, we're in trouble. And what they claim is that they've only been able to collect rent from like a third of their retail tenants, and everybody else has not been able to pay the rent. And so for them, that just exacerbates, ongoing problems. And, you know, people here are speculating, is this going to be the end of the mall? You know, is this company going to go bankrupt? And if it does the mall stay open?
And this is related to the pandemic, right? Not necessarily any looting or anything like that. I mean, these financial problems have been going back a few months, I take it?
Right. I would think of the looting that happened at the mall and the economic impact at the mall are sort of two separate things. I think
okay.
One was incidental to the other.
And like a lot of malls in Illinois, I gather that the Eastland Mall has already, even before the pandemic, seen its fair share of businesses and vacancies and things like that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And then you've got, you know, anchor stores. We lost our JCPenney, a couple of years ago, but that's, just one of the latest chains that has declared bankruptcy itself and is shutting down more stores. So just getting worse.
You know, sticking with the topic of the pandemic, Ryan, you've also reported on Illinois State University's reopening plan. Can you talk a little bit about what they are planning to do as we begin to think about the fall semester?
Sure, yeah. So like many other public universities, they are leaning toward a kind of a blended approach where you're going to have some on-campus, in-person classes and a lot of other classes taking place online. So for example, any class with 50 or more people, they're going to try to push online. They're thinking about giving every freshman the opportunity to take their entire first semester online if they so choose. But the dorms are going to be open and dining centers are going to be open. So there's still a lot of questions. I mean, the plan is really sort of a draft or an interim plan, as they call it. And, you know, it's already attracting concerns from faculty who are going to be the ones in the front lines. You know, if you think of a 60-year-old faculty member with perhaps an underlying health condition, you know, how comfortable are you going to be going back to work with a room full of 20-year-olds? It'll be an interesting August for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And the last thing I want to ask about is, Yvonne, you're covering the arts and culture community in WNIJ's listening area, which again is Rockford, DeKalb, Aurora, kind of north central Illinois. How is the sort of the world of culture adapting on account of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Oh, they're actually adapting well. A lot of them have turned to online. For example, in Aurora, they have this thing called First Fridays, where a lot of businesses and people in the community come together, network, and they go to different spots downtown. In April, they actually started doing it online. So this is the third month where they're having artists come together, musicians, and have performance online. I actually did a story with a local artist who was featured at a art gallery, and she showed all her stuff online. And then in Rockford, the Rockford Area Arts Council is also doing things. But this weekend, because we are in phase three, they did like an art safari where people were able to go in their cars and make purchases from different vendors and things like that. And they were allowing people to what they say park and peruse and walk around as long as they had their mask on and they were practicing social distance. And even in DeKalb, NIU, they're offering online music class this summer. So, you know, the music lessons and things, all those things are still taking place because of technology.
People trying to keep the ocean culture alive despite the pandemic. Yeah. Yvonne Booz is arts and culture reporter at Northern Public Radio, WNIJ, in Rockford and DeKalb. And Ryan Denham is digital content director at WGLT in Bloomington Normal. Yvonne and Ryan, thank you both for being with me this morning.
Thank you.
Apologies to Kristen Schorsch. We had some from WBEZ. We had some technical difficulties. Hope to have her back on in the near future. Just ahead, we're going to be talking about gay liberation and the important but often marginalized role that Black trans people in particular have had in that movement, plus a conversation about the cancellation of the Illinois State Fair. And before we take a break, I just want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. We've been hearing interesting things from listeners. It's informing our coverage. You can join it. It's called Text the 21st. Just text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. More to come after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Last year, the Human Rights Campaign tracked at least 26 deaths of transgender or gender nonconforming people in the U.S. on account of fatal violence. The majority of those deaths were Black transgender people. Those killed in just the past week include Raya Milton in Ohio and Dominique Remy Fells in Pennsylvania. So many trans women of color have lost their lives on account of violence that the American Medical Association has declared it an epidemic. Yet, despite the violence perpetrated against them, Black trans people are often the ones on the front lines fighting for change. 51 years ago, trans women of color were the ones clashing with police during the Stonewall riots in New York City. Now, Black trans people are again showing up and protesting, this time over the police killing of George Floyd. On Sunday in Chicago, there was a drag march for change in the Boys Town neighborhood, which speakers at the event said needs to be more welcoming and less oppressive toward Black LGBTQ people. So, as we celebrate Pride this year, who is putting their bodies on the line for Black trans people? For more on this, I spoke Friday with Lasaya Wade, Executive Director of Brave Space Alliance, and Stephanie Scora, Associate Executive Director of the same organization. Brave Space Alliance is a Black-led, trans-led LGBTQ center on the south side of Chicago. Lasaya, Stephanie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yes, thank you for having us.
I'd also like to welcome Jason Pearson. He's a professor of political science at the University of Illinois Springfield. His most recent book is an encyclopedia called LGBTQ Americans in the U.S. Political System. Professor Pearson, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And I'd like to begin, I guess, with a little bit of historical perspective, Jason. When we're talking about the origins of Pride Month and the modern LGBTQ rights movement, much of that goes back to the Stonewall riots. Can you walk us through what happened in June 1969?
Well, there
was a lot of activity that had been going on before then. There had been a decade and a half of some limited political and legal mobilizing. This is often referred to as the homophile movement. It was mostly lesbians and gay men, mostly gay men. During this time, there was an awful lot of police harassment of trans people, of queer people, in those organizations and outside of those organizations. And then in 1969, with the Stonewall riots, it was in response to relatively really routine police raids. What would happen is that police would often raid queer bars at the time, arrest people under state liquor and local liquor authorities and cross-dressing ordinances and all kinds of things. So there were all kinds of ways that police could harass and intrude on queer and trans people's lives during the time. But in 1969, one night during a raid, patrons fought back and challenged the police, and this led to clashing between the patrons of the bar and the police. And there were several nights of rioting and somewhat violent interactions between the patrons and the police at that night. And that is seen, so while it wasn't the first time this had happened, for instance, there's the Compton's Cafeteria riot in 1966 in San Francisco that was similar, but this was an instance that got a lot of national visibility and led to what many conceive of as the modern LGBTQ rights movement. And you have the first Pride parades taking place in 1970 to commemorate those events in 1969.
And Jason, I've noticed over the past few years that there seems to be a renewed focus on the contributions by trans women of color during the Stonewall riots. But would you say their contributions went largely unrecognized before that?
Absolutely. It's a huge historical oversight. The Stonewall Inn was a bar that a lot of middle-class white gay men did not go to. It was known to be a bar where folks who were a little bit more marginalized in society would go. And those folks were at the front lines, a lot of trans women of color in particular, at the front lines. Marsha P. Johnson, one of the most famous transgender rights activists of the time. She's often thought to have started the riots, but in fact, she acknowledged she came a little bit later, but was very much involved in the process. So trans women of color were particularly at the forefront of that event. Unfortunately, their role was downplayed or obscured for a long time.
Stephanie Scora from Brave Space Alliance is also with us. Stephanie, can you tell us more about the organization and what you all do?
Yes, so Brave Space Alliance, I think as we've said, is the first and only Black-led, trans-led LGBTQ organization focused on serving the South and West sides of Chicago. And really, you know, we work on the front lines of our communities in everyday resources and programming where we provide essential services such as mutual aid around housing, safer sex work, and food insecurity for the most marginalized members of our community. And lately, during the COVID-19 pandemic and the recent uprisings for Black Lives, Brave Space Alliance has started a crisis pantry the first week of the pandemic and have since served over 3,000 people with the crisis pantry alone. We've also launched a trans relief fund, which we've given away tens of thousands of dollars in micro grant support to members of our community who are in need, Black and brown trans people, primarily across the city of Chicago, who were laid off or had their income reduced for one reason or another during the pandemic. And the final thing that we've done is we've been really proud of our contribution during the recent uprising for Black Lives, where we have been really the only nonprofit on the ground in the city of Chicago focusing on Black trans lives. And we've been serving as an essential storage location and delivery location for food, water, medical supplies, PPE, other protest gear, so that people who are participating in these uprisings, whether that's through direct action on the ground, doing jail support for people unjustly jailed by the state in response to these uprisings, or whether folks are running pop-up locations to feed people whose neighborhoods have been impacted by protests or have just been disadvantaged and turned into food deserts by years of neglect from our city and our state. We have been a clearinghouse for all of those supplies, and we've been able to serve in the last couple of weeks alone almost 15,000 people through these emergency efforts.
Lasaya, the Brave Space Alliance issued a statement earlier this month as the protests over the killing of George Floyd gained momentum across the country. And the title of it was The Rebellion Must Be for All of Us. It actually cited Marsha P. Johnson, whom we heard about a few moments ago. And it said in part, quote, "Trans people have always been at the forefront of liberation movements, and yet far too often those movements forget that Black trans lives matter too. Just last night, a Black trans woman named Ayanna Dior was jumped by Black men at a protest in Minneapolis, and nobody stopped to intervene. Her life matters just as much as George Floyd's," unquote. Lasaya, can you talk more about that history of Black trans people putting their bodies and lives on the line for others, and how, in many cases, Black trans people have been written out of these conversations?
Yes. So a lot of the times, and most of the time, cis people do not want to recognize Black trans women because it brings in a narrative that they're not used to. And most of the time, most people don't really know all of Black trans women history, like Tracy Africa or Renee Richards or Lucy Hicks Anderson and Mary Jones. Mary Jones is a Black trans woman that was located in, she was the first Black trans woman in history to be documented fighting against the state around who she is. And next was Lucy Hicks Anderson, actually documented as well, fighting for her womanhood against this system as well. So it is a clear understanding that we've always been fighting against the system to recognize who we are. But it's another way of always saying, I am who I am, but also reminding people, I've always been Black, right? The understanding of we are not a subgroup. We will never be a subgroup, but I'm also understanding that I am a part of the LGBT community and actually telling them and letting other Black folks know that we've always had a place in society where society has always erased us.
If you're just tuning in, my guests today are Lasaya Wade, Executive Director of Brave Space Alliance, and Stephanie Scora, Associate Executive Director of the same organization. We've also been hearing from University of Illinois Springfield political science professor Jason Pearson. And Jason, can you talk more about the connection between policing and the LGBTQ rights movement more broadly? What does history tell us about Black trans women pushing back on police surveillance, for example?
Well, Black trans women of color have been always on the most severe edge of police harassment of the LGBTQ community. And the movement more generally has always struggled with police surveillance, harassment, arrests, and police violence. Right from the start of it, we know as the modern LGBTQ rights movement of the 1950s, trying to deal with police harassment, threat of arrest, the actual arrest of people being suspected of being sex workers or people being arrested for cross-dressing or a wide variety of infractions potentially, that the movement always had to struggle with the police as an oppressive force, quite frankly, and a huge barrier on political organizing. You know, people's lives could be ruined with their interactions with police because of incarceration or the notoriety of their arrest or incarceration. So it really goes back to the start of the LGBTQ rights movement, the interaction with the police. And that's why I think Stonewall is so important, because it was one of the moments where folks at least tried to break that system of oppression of marginalized folks.
I want to push back against that. We tried, but also it's a very clear narrative that once we spoke, we was booed off a stage like a Silver Rivera. Once we tried to speak about our transness is not in opposition to liberation of queerness, we was booed off a stage. And also we were that stepchild to the LGBT community when we was actually the mother to the LGBT community, and a place where the LGBT community has always, we've always loved our queer babies and making sure that they were okay before ourselves was even okay. But when it came down to
recognizing and acknowledging who we are, we are always placed in this position of, oh, they're not gay, oh, they're not lesbian, oh, they're not bisexual. So they are meaningless to us. And once we combat that, we are not trans women no more. We are actually become men. So it has been a push and pull, not only with our own Black or Brown communities, but also with the LGBT community as well, ever since the beginning of not wanting to recognize that we are not something to belittle within a community, because we want to be, the LGB wants to erase the T because it shows that you have left us behind in history.
Yeah, I think that I would concur with that completely. I think one of the most painful moments in the years after Stonewall is when Sylvia Rivera is literally, as you say, booed off the stage at a Pride event in New York. And she was trying to address issues dealing with people who are incarcerated, folks who are homeless in the trans community. And you're absolutely right that those issues were marginalized and not addressed by the larger movement at that time.
Stephanie, I wonder if you can talk about how that involvement continues into today, the idea of Black trans women pushing back on police surveillance, for example.
Yes, of course. Well, you know, I think a lot of it can be very clearly seen in the work of organizations like ours, like Brave Space Alliance, and in trans liberation organizing across cities, in cities across the country, large and small. You know, we often see that there are two different kinds of queer and trans organizing that take place in the country. There's the very funded, very visible, very resourced kind of activism that is often centered on white cisgender gay men, and occasionally white cisgender lesbians, and even more occasionally gay men and lesbians of color. And then we have the innovative, feisty, grassroots, really bear down and get done kinds of organizing that takes place in trans communities. Because what Lasaya is saying is absolutely accurate. You know, trans people have been pushed out of the resourced parts of our communities for so long. We aren't the ugly stepchild, the proverbial ugly stepchild of the queer liberation movement. We are its mothers. And yet we haven't seen any sort of return on our initial investment from the community. Instead, we've been pushed out, we've been ridiculed, we've been ostracized, we've been beaten and disenfranchised. And what that has given us actually is incredible focus on our own liberation, because we know, trans women know, and Black and Brown trans women know in particular, that when their needs are met, there's nothing that they can't do. And so you see a lot of trans liberation organizing focused on things like making sure sex workers are safe, making sure that everybody has housing, that everybody has food on their table every night, making sure that police aren't constantly harassing our communities, or that police are abolished entirely, because we know the police have never been friends to our community. And we see this sort of trickling into the mainstream LGBTQ organizing, but where the real innovation in trans liberation and in queer liberation is still coming from are Black and Brown trans women, who need to fight every day to make sure that the same things that have been happening since, you know, Christianity criminalized our existence don't continue to happen. Just last night and this morning, we found that two additional Black trans women were murdered in Philadelphia and in Ohio. And our community collectively is mourning their deaths. And we have a saying, mourn the dead and fight like hell for the living. Give us our roses while we're still here. And we have to make sure that we continue to bring our fire and our passion to the current uprising for Black lives, and make sure that the people on the ground right now are honoring the deaths and the lives of these Black trans women, so that we're not overlooked, so that our community isn't overlooked, and so that our contributions can be not only adequately recognized, but incorporated into the broader liberation strategy.
Okay, and we need to take a short break when we want to continue this important conversation. So stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, my guests today are Stephanie Scora and Lasaya Wade, both with the Brave Space Alliance. And we've also been speaking with University of Illinois Springfield political science professor Jason Pearson about the role of Black trans women in particular in the LGBTQ rights movement in America and how they've often been marginalized and what they're doing today to continue that fight. And Lasaya, just before we went to the break, we heard about recent tragedies in the community. And I wonder if you can talk about, you know, as the protests over the killing of George Floyd continue into Pride Month, what are some of the barriers to making sure that Black trans people are included in conversations about violence at the hands of others, including the police?
I think it's important for us to actually understand that I am your brother, I am your sister, I am you without you. I've always moved in a space of pulling people in and letting them know that we are together in this. I've always moved in a space where I let people know that if my neighbor is not okay, I am not okay. And if COVID-19 ain't taught us anything, it taught us that we're all connected through water, we're all connected through the air, and regardless of what it looks like, if you hurt, I have to hurt too. So how do we maneuver and move in this particular moment as Black people to fight for what we deem as liberation, but including all Black people? I think Black people first, Malcolm X said it the best. He said, if you wanted to hide something from a Black person, put it in the book. And it was important for myself to educate myself in a point and into pulling a particular language for Black people that do not have this higher education like myself, are not able to get higher education, to actually break down these particular barriers of their education to feed them what they need to know about my Black body, right? And in this moment and in this climate, everything is colliding together. It's a beautiful moment, but also a sad moment as well. It's a beautiful moment because now I can let them know what it looks like to be a Black trans woman. Now I can let them know that you will not be liberated without me in this moment. So it's a whole different type of level of communication that's happening right now. And especially as a person that is a core member of BLM Chicago, I can only vouch for Chicago and how Chicago and Illinois itself is fighting for Black life because I am a part of that. And we are, and we have had language and conversations around what does it look like for a trans or homophobic antagonist to be in the space, to have them conversations, to break down what it looks like for that particular type of hate. Because we have to change this narrative around phobia. Most of my community is not afraid of me. And what does it look like to actually have conversation around hate and how that hate was loved on, how that hate actually grew, and breaking it down around colonialism, around individualism, and especially around how you was taught not to actually love all Black people, but a particular type of Black person, uplifting them. So in this particular moment of political crisis, it's just pushing that particular narrative around, you will not be free unless all of us is free.
I want to talk about the concept of allyship for a minute as well. And Lasaya, I wonder if you can explain what allyship is and why that idea.
I hate allyship.
Yeah, well,
I hate the word allyship.
Please go off on that.
Allyship is like sharing a post on Facebook. Allyship is like sharing a picture of a dead person saying, rest in power. I need a person that is a comrade these days. And we need to change that again. Language is so important, and especially now. I need a comrade. If I'm fighting someone, I need someone flattening someone's tire so I can get away from that fight. I need someone to make sure that you hit them in the ankles and I can run away. I need you to put your body on the line for me now more than ever as a Black woman. First and foremost, I need someone to help me. Again, Malcolm X said it worst, the person that's most marginalized within this community, I can't say the exact words, is Black women throughout the world, and how we are disrespected on so many levels, not only in transness, but also queerness. Also just being a Black woman, period, in a society that has dissected Black women to save other people and not have given the just dues and a due diligence around Black women body. No, I don't need an ally. I need a comrade. And there's a big difference between the two.
I want to shift gears a little bit and bring Jason Pearson, professor at the University of Illinois Springfield in political science, back into the conversation. Although we've been hearing Pride did have rebellious roots, over the past few years, the celebrations and the month in general have become more and more commodified, right? Big companies make rainbow merchandise and have parade floats and change their logos. Do you think this year might be a chance to separate some of that, you know, kind of consumerism and get back to the roots that Pride once had?
I think so. I would hope so. Although it's you know, perhaps too soon to be seen, but there's a lot of grassroots organizing around that issue. And also there's been the issue the last several years of separating police involvement with Pride celebrations as well, given the history we've been talking about. And those conversations were starting before the events of the last few weeks. I think they've accelerated enormously. And I think they will be continuing at a much greater level. And those are certainly conversations that need to be had, particularly about what the real legacy of Pride is, of Stonewall, of that moment, and who was in and who was out, and who has been in and out of that conversation in the decades since.
And Lasaya, I wonder, how are you looking at Pride this year? Are you hopeful that there might be a change in how we celebrate Black queer lives year round?
I am Sylvia Rivera this year, and I am homing what she said, Pride. And it's important for me to say that language. Until you recognize the history of the rebellion of Pride, until you recognize the life of Black people liberating other people before they liberate themselves, Pride. And we have to understand what that looks like. As a Black trans woman, I wear my pride on my shoulders. And we have done that with our bodies on the streets, our blood that drain these streets. Until you recognize my life, I cannot allow you to recognize other people's before mine.
And Stephanie, last question to you. What would a truly inclusive Pride and a truly inclusive Black Lives Matter movement look like to you?
You know, I think in terms of Pride, I think, you know, actually in terms of both, we need to hand these movements over to the folks that created them, queer Black women and queer Black trans women. Pride is not Pride unless it's centering the people who created the movement. You know, I don't care if we have Target and Bank of America and, you know, 50 different kinds of alcohol companies marching with rainbow shirts and whatnot, that doesn't mean anything to the actual liberation of our community. You know, a lot of those companies are there because they want our money. They know that we have money now and they want us to spend it there. But that doesn't do anything for our rights. That doesn't do anything for our liberation. That doesn't do anything for our ability to survive or thrive in a system and a world that is constantly trying to kill us. If we turn Pride over to Black and brown trans women, then it will start to get back to its radical root of queer rage, queer liberation, trans rage, trans liberation, and getting power and resources to the people and meeting our needs and the liberatory desires and visions of Black trans women.
Stephanie Scora is Associate Executive Director of the Brave Space Alliance. We've also been speaking with Lasaya Wade, executive director of the Brave Space Alliance, which is a Black-led, trans-led LGBTQ center on the south side of Chicago. And we've also been speaking with Jason Pearson, professor of political science at the University of Illinois Springfield. His most recent book is an encyclopedia called LGBTQ Americans in the U.S. Political System. Stephanie, Lasaya, and Jason, thank you all so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The governor announced Friday that the Illinois State Fair in Springfield would be canceled this year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. That also applies to the DeCoin State Fair in southern Illinois. The last time the State Fair was canceled was in 1945 during World War II, and before that, the Civil War. And a year without the State Fair for many of us means a year without our favorite State Fair foods. Ken Vose joins us now. He's the owner of Vose's Concessions, known to generations of fairgoers as Vose Fine Food and Drink. And their corn dogs have been a State Fair staple in Illinois for decades. Ken, welcome to the 21st.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well, but I'm already sort of a little sad that I'm not going to be able to get my corn dog fix this year. Or maybe we'll figure something else out. I don't know. But I want to know from our listeners if there are State Fair foods you look forward to. You can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. So, Ken, how long have you and your family been selling corn dogs at the State Fair?
Well, this year would have been 54 years, and don't look like we're going to make that one. And so hopefully it'll happen again in 21.
Sure. Now, if people aren't familiar, and I realize that most of our Springfield listeners probably are familiar, but for those who are maybe outside, your setup is located right across from the grandstand, which is where all the concerts are. It's where the horse racing, the auto racing is at the fairgrounds. And, you know, politicians come to the fair, musical acts. I'm wondering, you know, have you ever, you know, what's your best corn dog story in terms of memorable people you might have served at the state fairgrounds?
There's probably a lot of them, but we've served, there's a lot of entertainers who've sent over for corn dogs, and we've sent corn dogs over to quite a few different ones. And, you know, last year, one of the guys from Shinedown came over himself, and a couple years ago, Eddie Montgomery came over and got one. We've sent some over to Leonard Skinner.
Sure.
A couple years ago, and so there's been, over the years, been quite a few different ones that had them, and that's probably the stories I've got. I mean,
yeah, sure. So how were you feeling when you found out the State Fair would be canceled this year?
Oh, pretty sad, just like all the other vendors out there. I mean, it's a big part of our life, and when we get to see people that we haven't seen since last year, and all the customers that come back every year and bring new ones along with them. So it's going to be hard to go through August without the fair.
And do you agree with the governor's decision to cancel it?
I don't know. I'm not in favor of it. I think they could have worked around some things, in my opinion, but, you know, that may not mean much to some people. But no, I don't know. I think it had a shot, and maybe they should have went for it.
Hmm. So have you ever missed a state fair in the past? You said 51 years, was it?
It would have been 54 this year.
54, excuse me, yes.
Yeah. No, nothing's ever come about to cause it not to be there. So we've been there every year.
Hmm. And so last question for you. I wonder if people cannot, you know, they're not going to be able to get a Vose's corn dog at the state fair this year. Do you have any recommendations of how they might be able to get their fix?
Well, we've been open on weekends out there at the state.
Oh, you have? Okay.
And, yep, and through July, we're planning on opening Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from about 11 to 3. So people can come out and get a chance to get one. And we'll be up in Mechanicsburg on the 4th of July for their festival. So, yeah, people will have a chance to get one yet, you know, through the July and some of August.
All right. Well, I guess all is not lost if you are hankering for a Vose corn dog this year. Ken Vose is the owner of Vose's Fine Food and Drink. Ken, thanks so much for being with us on the 21st today.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for today. I want to make another pitch for joining our texting group, Text the 21st. We've been hearing interesting things from you, our listeners. It is informing our coverage. You can join us by texting the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, the word is TALK to 217-803-0730. Should also subscribe to our podcast. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One, anywhere you can find podcasts. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpasan is our engagement producer, and our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.